This morning is June 1st, 1978, and seated in my office is George Osterman, who is retiring this year as a member of the biology department. Let's start off first, George, with the year that you came here. 69, was it?
No, that was 59.
59, yeah, all right.
I get mixed up on that. All right. Too. I always want to say 69, too.
59. So it goes back a longer time.
Yes, that's right.
And you came here
when with Russell and someone in German, I've forgotten who it was.
Kyler?
Yeah, Kyler.
Yes,
right.
Kyler.
And,
right.
It seemed to me there were four of us, and I can't remember who else it was, but Russell and I are the only ones that are left
that survived.
Oh, Cunningham, yes.
Oh, yes.
Right. Department. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were four of us.
Mm-hmm. And at the time you came, Bracey was, of course, president.
And Christy was
just starting
dean,
as dean, right. And Dr. Blount was chairman of the department at that
That's
time.
That's right, and Engel was still there. Stayed there for 1 year and then retired.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Yeah, he married...
he married Dorothy Keck.
Yeah, you remember those names. I guess you knew them better.
I knew them, yes. She taught English here. I knew that. Well, as you look back over the years, what prompted you to make a decision to come from Western Pennsylvania to Eastern Ohio, George?
I think the main thing was I needed the job.
You needed the job. Well, I think that's as good an answer as any.
Yes, and I was at a conference up in Pymatune, the University of Pittsburgh was staging, and I knew Cunningham from several years before. He was student at Pitt, and he had been accepted here, in May, I think, or April, and he said there was still an opening here, so I applied, and I think that must have been in June, and I don't know for sure what month it was. It must have been in June or July that I was accepted, so that was how I got here.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you came... And as you look back on it now, what would you say are changes in the biology department, course offering, teaching-wise? Has it changed appreciably, do you think?
Well, there have always been four in the department. When I came, it was Engel and Cunningham and Blount and I. And as far as the kind of courses that were offered then and the courses that are offered now, I don't think there's too much change that's actually taking place. Most of the change, I think, occurred when Jerry was on his leave and left the three of us in charge then and had a curriculum revision and made some changes. Most of them, I think, were... the changes that Leonard made in his courses, and then had been an introduction in an expansion of botany. Since when I came, Jerry was teaching the botany with one course, and Rusty coming in, replacing the position that Cunningham had, and replacing that, there have been an development of the botany courses. I think they're now beginning botany course and three advanced courses in botany. That have come in. Leonard's courses introduced a course in invertebrates, which we didn't have before, and students had a chance for a little bit of marine experience with that. They get out on the coast and spend a week down there. My courses and Jerry's courses, I think, have remained rather stable over the years. The only thing I think that I've added. There was a course in entomology in the last 2 years, and a course in behavior, which has been about 7 years. The course in behavior is one that Alphalon started.
Yes.
I picked it up after he left. But all in all, I don't think there's been too much real change as far as course offering.
What about bioethics or some... title like that, this approach to in biology, has this influenced, do you think?
I think the thing you're referring to is that Bill Porter in sociology and I tried to offer course, cross-disciplinary course in biosociology. We tried that for a couple of summers and had moderate enrollment, but didn't seem to be any kind of a course that had too much appeal. Mm-hmm. Jerry, one term, gave a course in bioethics or a seminar in bioethics. Then I think the whole idea has been picked up and taken by Murdoch in chemistry is the nature of man's course that he has the ethics side of it.
Well, you've had a, always been impressed with a good rapport that you have with students, George, and in your teaching and outside classroom relations. Do you want to comment about, you think there's a change in students from the time you came to now, or has the pendulum swung back again?
Oh, I think there's very definite kind of change. You look back over the years, both here and where I was in W&J. I don't know whether there's any kind of a trend in students as much as it is that different classes have different kinds of students or people in them. Mm-hmm. And each class, class in entomology is a different kind of student than you get in a class in physiology, mm-hmm. different attitudes. And the year division classes, each one of those has its own definite composition. Mm-hmm. It's a little different. I don't know, memory is sort of hazy when you can sort of say, well, this was a better class than the mm-hmm. ones you have now and so forth. But I think you get your mixture. You get the ones that are interested, the ones that are perhaps not too much interested, the ones that are the ones with good potential that you can't get started. Mm-hmm. And each class, I think, has the same kind of composition. I don't see that there's anything particularly different. I think where the differences come in is perhaps mostly in non-academic kinds of things, essentially what they're wearing and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but how it's becoming more or less apparent on campus that going back to more traditional kinds of dress, you see more girls now with dresses and not all of them with the sloppy jean look, and the overall craze seems to have passed. And for the fellows, noticed it on Y'all Men's Banquet, for instance, and noticed in the last couple of years on the honors convocation, more students look neat, many of them with the three-piece suit and tie.
I was interested last spring. I was doing a tape with Glenn Clark, was retiring at that time, and Glenn was commenting about this, that when he first came, the girls were usually all dressed up, even for a 750 class, and he said, he didn't know whether that made them add or subtract any better, but he said they looked a lot better in the classroom as far as he was concerned, but he began to notice a little change in that.
I think it's interesting how things have changed and what you tolerate. It took a little while to get used to, particularly the blacks in class and not some of the whites. But it's simply the hats on or caps and never bothered to take them off. And how you tolerate that. And I keep thinking about it, the stories you used to hear about Morgan. Mm-hmm. A girl in the summer course let the girls come in with shorts on. Yeah. Now, you don't think of the thing out of the class I just had. No, I think about half of them had shorts on. Mm-hmm. And they're in a regular class, a regular school, it isn't even a summer school class. But you learn to tolerate a lot of things, I think.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago at the height of the protest, Bill Morgan came by a commencement procession, and he had been marshal for about 20 years when he was here, and he said that I guess it was a good thing that he had retired. He wasn't on hand. He just couldn't stand the casualness. And as you say, there's a...
Well, I don't think it's just students. You look at it, I noticed it particularly in Blount. He was quite a stickler that you couldn't come to class without a tie on. You know? Mm-hmm. And he always wore his white coat. But then after he took his leave and went out on the West Coast and he came back, you very rarely see him nowadays with a tie on. Mm-hmm. It's a very casual situation. The dress code that he's taking, I imagine the students pick up from that.
This is probably true. Of course, I suppose being on the campus of Davis where he was would do that.
Yeah, well, he used to say something about how they came, he staff members even barefooted in class and so forth. But the thing that just seems to me, you know, in a bit of mouth, you look at other campus ethos or behaviors or dress, and it always seemed to me that you could figure out that what was current, even in a place like Hiram, maybe, or Marietta, or Capitol, or some of the other schools in the area, that you could see a dress form on those campuses. You figured that it's going to be about a year or two.
It's
here. Uh-huh. And that everybody else in the other campuses have given it up, and that's what's going to be here. Mm-hmm. I think the last one was this overall fix.
Yes.
It's gone last year, it's died out this year.
But right.
That had gone through most of the campuses three, 4, 5 years ago.
Right.
It's no longer on those places. I don't know. See, that's a thing that I've often thought about. Well, it just seems to be stuck in an eddy or something.
Uh-huh.
By itself, isolated. And what goes on in the rest of the world doesn't happen on Mount until it's gone by somewhere else. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask, personality-wise, of course, you have more contact with science people, but if there are some personalities who made an impression, I can think of one, Gertrude Hinch, who was in your department, was a research-oriented person, I guess you'd say. I don't know whether there were other individuals that impressed you. I know you've had a close relationship with Bill Porter over the years in sociology.
Well, I don't know. I think in science, particularly down there, I think it's a whole group of rather individualistic people. It's not a really harmonious kind of fitting together type of thing. But I guess that's, as far as I understand, it's been the pattern all the time with the science area group. I don't know. I don't think there's anyone with any of those characteristics that you used to look at. You know, this was a professorial type, and you look back at it and say, these were the idiosyncrasies you associate with the profession. I don't think there are any of those anymore. These don't seem to be.
What do you think change-wise when you came, the type of college this was, the emphasis? Do you think we're going to have deserted the liberal arts, as they feel on many campuses, and going to a sort of practical approach to education, or do you think we still pay allegiance to that?
I really don't know how to cope with that question. What it seems to me, the change that I've noticed, I think, is mostly that when I came with the Christie and Bracey axes, and the staff that we had at that time, the thing that impressed me was that it was a really viable, exciting phase that the school was going through. It seemed that we were going to be doing things. But then over the period of the years, particularly, I guess, of the unrest in the 60s and so forth, I don't know, it seems to me we've more or less just gone into a holding pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to be any looking into the future. This is what we're going to do, and it seems mostly sort of just holding on to what we have, and a reluctance, it seems, on many parts to be at least innovative or creative or to introduce something that's enough different that it makes an exciting kind of situation. Mm-hmm. we try anything new that's got so much traditional in it that it really isn't
innovative.
That's mm-hmm. right. Yes, that seems to me that it's mm-hmm. it is the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, during the time that you were here, you moved outside of Alliance, in fact, more than partway between here and Minerva, so you had an allegiance to two places almost, and
you're... I've been out in limbo, I think.
Yes, right.
That's the right question, right. Because it didn't belong in either place.
Well, I wouldn't say that. How far, mileage, how far is it, 8 miles?
8 miles this way, 6 to Minerva.
Yes. And so you were oriented church-wise to the Presbyterian Church in Minerva, is that right?
That's right.
And you served on the library board at the public library at Minerva,
right.
too. I knew that. So that although your campus activities were here, your other activities were oriented more toward the Minerva.
Yeah, that's
base.
When I went to school in Minerva and
right.
tied in with those church activities
yeah.
and so forth. This with the Alliance has been a minimal kind of association
yes.
with the community affairs in the Alliance,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Well, of course, we noted with regret the passing of your wife, and I'm sure that in retirement you had plans, things you wanted to travel or do together, but your four children, one of them attended, graduated from Mount.
That's right, Christine.
Christine. And the other three then, and...
Well, they're getting scattered now. One's in Washington and one's in Bloomington. And the youngest one took off for Maine, so he's up there for the summer part of it. And then he'll be at the University of Chicago in chemistry in the fall.
But you should be very proud. They've all done quite well in their work and in the studies that they have pursued.
Yeah, they have done quite well. I'm surprised, I guess.
Well, I guess it's a chip off the old block or the academic influence or something, George, that has opened that.
Easy schools to go to.
No, I don't think that. I think they did
quite well.
I thought
it was interesting that they seemed to find the school that they fitted into
mm-hmm.
and were very happy and they've all had very close and very good relations with
mm-hmm.
some departments, some group.
Yes.
Except one here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here it was wasn't the kind of time. You know, that's the other thing I've noticed about Mount, that compared to some of the other schools, the minimal amount of activity and interaction that we have with the students
mm-hmm.
out of classroom.
Yes.
And to notice that at Hiram with John, the number of things that he got involved in and the large amount of time that he spent in the professor's home, and the same way with David, and the little things that they seem to do for their students in departments. Each department down there currently has some sort of a picnic arrangement that apparently everybody goes to, and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I'm as much at fault as anybody, but it just doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that's done very much here.
Well, now this is, of course, it seems rather ironical because, I suppose during the latter part of the administration of President McMaster, say from World War I till 1938 and he retired, he liked to refer to this as the happy family. And of course, like families, there are occasionally disagreements and little misunderstandings, but on the whole, there was this sort of a homogeneity, a close-knitness, and I don't know whether it was the war and changes in administration that have, but we don't seem to have that as we once did.
Yes, that's what I'm looking at some of these other schools, how much more, I mean, in
mm-hmm.
just my kids. Of course,
yes.
Perhaps there are an awful lot of them that don't have that kind of relationship,
mm-hmm.
but at least it seemed to be that there was a greater friendliness with the staff members and students.
Yeah.
Than we have.
Well, this is something we certainly will have to promote just to ensure survival, if nothing else. It's a sort of self-protection.
I know that's what they're getting concerned with in the department, is this idea that morale seems to be down. But I don't know what you have to do. I guess it's a little self-searching on your own part, and not just put a good job with a student.
Right.
It's something they have to manipulate there. But I don't know. I think the first years I was here, it seemed to be that you had a more friendly relationship. I know you've had students home to your home.
Yes.
And I know years ago we used to have, not an awful lot, but we used to have students come down. But in the last several years, it just doesn't seem to be. I don't think it looks like anybody does, at least in the department, I don't think there's much of that.
Yes.
Or any of it, if it takes place.
No, I think we could have more of that interaction. Well, have you stopped to think what you're going to do now when September rolls around next year? I mean, the school bell rings, or the bell rings in Wilson Hall and Lamborn Hall, and
I don't know. I've often thought about that. What's it going to be like, you know, after you've been doing this for about 40 years, and each fall you go through a definite kind of pattern.
Yes.
And what's going to happen, you know, when that isn't there anymore, and what the reaction's going to be. I don't know. I don't think it's going to be very traumatic at all. I think I pretty well made up my mind that I'm just out of it. I'm done.
Yes.
What I'm going to do, I don't know. I can just wait and see what,
sure,
what develops.
Yeah. I suppose you can, of course, you have your children that you can visit and other things that you would like to do. Do you have anything in the area of biology you'd pursue as a hobby? Anything that you would like to?
Yes. I've got several things in the back of my head that I'd like to do in that kind of an area as well. But more importantly, what I'd like to do is to get into some type of activity where you feel that you have some usefulness, whether it is in some church-related activity, social activity of some sort, or other, that you have a feeling of being a part of something, or feel that you're making some kind of a useful contribution, and it's simply not your own particular needs and so forth that you satisfy.
Of course, I notice many of the individuals that I have known who have retired indicate that they're busier, if that's possible, in retirement than they were with their regular routine, regular job. That if you have this desire to do something, then probably you'll find that.
I don't think there's any doubt about it that there's in fact a lot of openings one type or another to get into.
How would you classify yourself? Biologists are always classifying into different genus and type and all. What's your major interest, George? What has been? How would you type yourself, classify as a biologist?
I don't know. Deep down underneath, that I haven't had too much chance to really work at it the way I'd like to. I think it'd be more in entomology than almost anything.
Is that right?
That's right. Yes. And sort of an outdoor, indoor combination thing rather than simply being inside in a laboratory all the time. I don't know, I feel that when you look at things, I feel hopelessly antiquated and out of date when you look at what you can do now with all of the different kinds of instrumentation and so forth. That's all developed since I went to school. It's just in a way turns me off.
What about this whole matter of spatialization? And I often use the example, you know, in a large university, the professor was taking his group across the campus, and a boy turned to say something to a girl and bumped into a tree, and he said, "I don't know what this is, but the cellular structure is so and so." And What do you think about this high degree? And kids come in and want to do this specialization and go off and do a project, but what about the general background that they need?
Well, being as the dean classifies me as a generalist, I guess in that I think personally I miss things, and that's what I've been trying to do, particularly in the last several years, is to try to get them to see things in relationship to a whole. And as I gather it, outside the specialty journals, you have in biology, there seems to be a trend, or at least the expression of a need for the more holistic approach that you would have in biology. And I notice in medicine that seems to be the thing that is coming too, is this holistic approach in which you bring together a lot of these things that apparently have been on the margin and have been even excluded, and bring them into the fold and to use them. And that's another change, you know. You just look at the difference in biology now, that things that are respectable now that weren't at one time, you know, the explorations into an interest in acupunctures and parapsychology and all of those things that that you didn't look at and didn't acknowledge at one time.
Now I recall, well, you would be here, I'm sure, but I had J.B. Ryan from Duke here at a lecture, and I remember Francis Christie was dean, and he really gave me a bad time, and he used to joke about the pseudo-intellectual they had over at the library, bringing in a person like that to, you know, he said, what will people think about Mount Union College, you see? And but as I recall, I forget where we were going to hold it, but we had to have it at the Union Avenue Church, and we had the biggest crowd. I never saw such a turnout as we had that night.
I remember that. I remember that.
Just a tremendous turnout. And as you say, if we'd have someone like that now, no one would blink an eye. They would say this is perfectly academically respectable. So
when you're talking about Christie, they had big classes in the beginning biology class, and Jerry had assigned me to that after Engel resigned, and no place to hold it except over in Rodman. And of course that had very primitive lighting, of course, and they had to use blackboards, and they had no blackboards, so they rounded up two old, decrepit, portable blackboards that the janitor had to come in and nail down to the floor for me in the morning when he came. But I had asked Christie when he came to the section on evolution if he would come over and present some of the philosophical or the religious side or whatever it was, you know. So because I had the blackboards and they were small, the janitor always provided me with a bucket of water and a sponge so that you could wash one blackboard off and write with the other, because they had to write fairly large and used up the blackboard fairly fast. And so this morning that Christie came in, and the bucket was sitting beside the podium that he had up there, you know, the way he had of coming up and just standing there and looking at the bucket and standing there and thinking for a minute and looking at the bucket again. He said, whoever teaches this class must have an awful hangover in order to have a bucket full of water.
Well, that was, well, I'll see, had Lambourne been redone when
yes,
you came?
Yes, it was done the year before I came. It was still on the show list for that first year I was here.
Yes.
We had the tours through it to show what had been done and so forth. Now I think they're just as happy if people don't notice it as far as that goes.
Of course, as you were pointing out earlier, things are relative. Many years ago, all the science was on the two rooms in the second floor of Chapman Hall, and the drain pipes from chemistry, I remember, were getting stopped up, or they were getting corroded and eaten out. And then when they moved to Lambourne, they had all the science there. They thought that was just tremendous.
That was before your time.
Oh, yes, yeah.
That's what I thought.
No, but I...
Lamborn was, what, 24?
No, Lamborn was 14, 1914.
What?
Yeah. Lamborn's 1914.
Oh, maybe it's Elliot.
It's same time, 14. Yeah, you know, the observatory was 24. The old observatory was 24.
Oh, well, the cornerstone's down there. I thought I'd looked at it. I thought it was in the 20s.
No, it should be around 1912. The cornerstone was laid and was completed about 19. I think they were in operation by 1914 or thereabouts. But no, all the science was conducted in Lamborn Hall, and that was considered to be quite the show place. And they turned out some pretty credible scientists, too.
Yeah. I know at W.J. when I went there, the chemistry was on the fourth floor of the old main building.
Mm-hmm.
They had the same kind of problems,
yes,
with drips and so forth on,
right,
the third floor.
Yes.
But then they got a new chemistry building, and biology had been, I guess it had been crowded in there at one time, too, in one room thing. And they had remodeled a grade school, but an academy, I guess, had been on the campus, and biology was in that for certain reasons.
Mm-hmm. What is the use of the farm out towards you, George? Is that a rented proposition, or is that a grant to the... that farm?
I don't really know what the details on it. As far as I understand it, when they gave it, and that Stephen Humphrey was here, and I think you remember him.
Yes.
He was sort of a pusher for that. He was really interested in it. He built a little shelter out there and things. So the information I know about it, I got mostly through him, and that is that, I can't remember his name now. The doctor, whose grandfather, I guess, and father owned the old farm, that it's simply a matter that the school has the use of it. And as far as I understand, there's no other transaction involved,
yes,
in it. But he still has it. But as far as the use is concerned, the first year, I guess, the geology was out, and Brusky was out. But aside from maybe taking the students down for botany once in spring and maybe a few times the ecology class in the fall, and we make no use of it. It isn't, without a building of some sort on it, it isn't of much value.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those places also need some sort of an atonement pond of some sort, and that has nothing on it. No chance of having one.
Oh, I see. Well, that would limit the use then.
Yes, it's an extremely limited type of thing, I imagine, as far as one of those publicity things. You can say you have a farm, but that's about all that amounts to. Have you been down there?
I just buy it. I'm not, I know just roughly where it is.
Yeah.
Do you think that is a possibility if there would be a tract of land that had, say, a pond and a marsh or a bog? Do you think that's can be a part of the biology program, a viable part?
Oh, in a way, I think you find that you could do a number of things with it. It depends upon the kind of stimulus you have,
yes,
I guess, from the staff and how they want to take part in it. But I think those are, again, fad things. And I think as far as the department's concerned, there are too many pulling in too many different directions, there wouldn't be any kind of a development that would be sustained kind of development.
Yes.
I mean, you could have it for a year or two maybe, and then after that it would die down and lose out on it again.
Now, to go back quite a few years, when I was a student here, and of course before that and for a time afterwards, the department, both biology and chemistry here, were noted for strong preparation of doctors. It was a pre-medics, and of course in chemistry many went on to be professional chemists. Time and situations, circumstances have altered this. What do you see as the role of a biology department like Mount Union now? There's a new medical school complex going in, which ties in with Kent, Akron, Youngstown. What future do you see? Is there any at all for a pre-medic type development like we used to have?
Well, I think, as I remember, you know, when I first came, it was still a good bit of Scott's influence.
Yes.
It was still running through the campus, and that sort of died out, I think. We've had our ups and downs as far as the number of pre-meds is concerned. But I don't know, I pick up little things every once in a while from a completely unrelated source. Someone was telling me that the school has a very good reputation as a pre-med place, so that it hasn't lost that identity, I don't think. But what I felt for a long time was that you have to take into consideration that things have changed a great deal, and you have what they term now as allied health careers. So that would be more emphasis on such things as the med techs and the inhalation therapy, and most of which at the present time perhaps require only 2 years, maybe, not a terminal college degree. But there's been a reluctance, I think, in the department to think in terms of courses and setting themselves up to take care of that particular group. And the ones that have been favored are the ones that go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the courses oriented to thinking oriented along that particular line. I was talking to Dean Lance several months ago. Had picked up the same idea.
Yes.
That if you had a sort of a stratum of students, and these were the ones you looked after first and then down the line. But I think the courses need to be of a broader base, more perhaps, I don't know if you'd want it non-liberal arts-oriented or profession-oriented, but courses that are a little bit more in that direction, I think, rather than simply graduate school preparation. That seems to me that's where the emphasis has been for a while. And,
well, I suppose with the shrinking enrollments, this will bring reality pretty close, and all departments will have to do some soul searching, and maybe out of that will come this different emphasis in biology.
Well, I think it's a difference in content, of course, essentially. For instance, I can see it in chemistry, that they're still the same professional chemist approach for a number of the students who really don't have any interest in any aptitude really for that kind of chemistry. That maybe they need a couple of different kinds of chemistry, or that courses that operate on a couple of different levels. This is what I mean. There's nothing innovative in that. It's you do it exactly the same way. Essentially, you look at it. You're doing exactly the same experiments you did the year before that. So forth, regardless of what the student mixture is, and of course, that's perhaps where the shortcoming is, to not realize that you've got different students and with different aptitudes, and you adapt, of course, to that rather than try to force the student into the pattern of the course.
Well, I know you've been interested in trying to spark some intellectual curiosity and thinking on a part of students. I'm interested in a more general approach, but it's a reading background, and it seems to me that many students, a great majority, are just woefully inadequate, at least by my standards, in this. And I wondered what sage advice you would have. How can you spark this on the? Here's an English major, but you should read something in biology, or vice versa. And I've tried to talk with students, and of course you get the stock reply, it's busy, if I can keep up with the other, etc. What can we do with these? I think it was the president of Chicago, you know, who died here, former president.
Hutchins,
who said, you know, a few years ago in the McCarthy era, you don't need to join the book burners. All you need to do is leave the books unread for a generation, and you've accomplished the same thing as Hitler or McCarthy who would burn the books. Mm-hmm. And this has no shock appeal with some of these students. So if they don't read them, so what?
I don't know. It's a very general problem.
Yeah.
I don't know what they spend their time on. I know a number of the biology majors, they spend an awful lot of time over there in the building with a nose in the book. But I think what they're doing is something they're just going over their textbook. And I think this is a kind of the name that's made on a lot of times, is simply that they get that contact attempt out of that book, and that's it. But anything aside, you don't get much. But every once in a while, you run across a student who has read something different, so he's turned them on, and he's interested in, but they're few and far between. I know that's been a problem ever since you've been on that library committee up here.
Yes.
It's library use seats, and you get that going.
That's right.
You know, it's a funny thing when you compare and look at the figures that you get. I suppose you had them down at the Alliance Library as well, and had them at the Minerva. The increase in the use of the library.
Yes.
Each month, you know, seem to have a few more. Except maybe for the middle summer months when it dropped off, but then it always increased, and the number of cards that it took out to increase. But here, I don't think you keep that kind of record. But you wonder, except when books have to be read for papers or something of that sort, I don't imagine you've got very much of a turnover.
No, not too much. It seemed to me when I first came here, and in 40, the late 30s and the first couple of years in the 40 of the war made the impact, was really, as far as a general background reading, students were doing the best job, I think, that we've ever had in this institution. But it's certainly tapered off since that time.
I don't know. Some of the courses I've gone over made out the reading list. And like the animal behavior, deliberately put some things on that were not straightforward books of behavior, but the ones that such as the bestiary or something of that sort, or some of Aristotle's works or something. They never selected those, of course.
Yes, I'm sure.
But they did read, but they only read the two. They required two, they read two.
Yeah.
They required one, they read one. And that was all there was to it. And they would generally say, oh, this is, you know, really a good book, I like that, and so forth. But I imagine if they followed it up, they would never have going over and reading another.
Well, of course, I think this is what the people at Harvard, the faculty, many of them felt, that they had to have a little more content, and the curriculum had to be structured, there had to be requirements, and at least they're trying to buck this whole trend of the unstructured and the cafeteria-type offering. But it's a real problem.
I can see it, because you could have a core on a course. But you could structure it around your topics, and your topics, ones that had some depth to it and so forth. And maybe we could get away from this idea of having to meet in class for so many minutes at a certain time of the day. But I think you could do a lot more. And it would perhaps be a mess for a number of the students that want the security of the content-oriented.
Yeah, some of them are conditioned, that's true.
Yes, true. You've got so many that are.
Well, our tape's running about to the end there. Appreciated very much this opportunity to talk with you, George, and get this down on tape.